everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Hello, everyone. I am your host, Dr. Balan A. Durr. And, you know, I know that as a spiritual being or an energy being, that in order for us to demonstrate our infinite potential, we have to have hands and feet. And in order for us to have hands and feet, we need to then have a brain that operates that hand and feet. So in order to have the greatest demonstration of the infinite potential that we are as star children, that the brain then is what I call the gateway to having that greatest demonstration. And so in order to have that, the healthier your brain, the healthier and the greater are your demonstrations. So today, joining me is my guest, Dr. Gretchen Bowles, a psychologist and actually a prescribing psychologist. So welcome, Dr. Gretchen.
Thank you very much, Dr. Balan. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, you know what? I, of course, I'm so happy to have you here and was so looking forward to having this conversation with you because, you know, you're kind of like a unicorn. Right?
I am. Right.
And, you know, just to give the audience some background as to why I'm saying that, Dr. Gretchen Bowles is a licensed clinical psychologist here in the state of Illinois and for over 25 years. And then she's also an adjunct professor at the Elmhurst College, where she teaches undergraduate sciences. She is the fifth licensed prescribing psychologist in the state of Illinois and the first prescribing psychologist to treat patients at Ascension Community Health Center in Arlington Heights. She's also, again, been in private practice for over 25 years. She's the founder and CEO of Bowles Clinical Psychology Group in Burr Ridge. And, you know, again, Dr. Bowles is the program manager for the Lexium Brothers Ascension Illinois Health Systems Prescribing Psychology Fellowship Program. I believe the only one of its kind in terms of the of an approved program by the state of Illinois. So that is why I'm calling Dr. Gretchen a unicorn, because there are only, unless it's changed recently.
It has only, changed.
Right. Well, I was going to say, but there are only like five states in the United States, right, in the U.S. that actually have prescribing psychologists. And correct, then Illinois being one of them. And then there, of course, there are a small number, relatively small number of prescribing psychologists. So, you know, one of the things that I know to be true is a lot of folks are even unaware of the difference between what you do as a psychologist and what I do as a psychiatrist, right?
Right.
And so, of course, I'm a medical doctor. And you have a doctorate in psychology, so you have a PsyD. But why don't you tell us a bit more about what makes you different as a psychologist from me as a psychiatrist?
Okay, so I was thinking about that before the show, and I thought you're right. I don't think a lot of people know the difference, so I thought I'd give a little historical background on the two. So a psychiatrist is, you know, a medical specialty. And it's
right,
been around.
Right, meaning I went to medical school.
You went to medical
school. Could have been a
surgeon,
could have been a pediatrician, could have been
right,
an oncologist, an OB/GYN. So I'm a medical doctor.
And with that, you are really able to prescribe any medication that you would like because you have gone through all of that training and you can work with some, you know, medically challenged cases. The psychology route is a little bit different. We really didn't come into being until after World War II, and we started out as sort of the assessment people, and we did a lot of testing, and that's where we started. And it was the 1950s with the Carl Rogers and Albert Ellis and those folks that we started to get into psychotherapy. And then in the 1960s, APA recognized psychopharmacology as a subset discipline of psychology. So, prior to the 2000s, we were doing testing and psychotherapy strictly for mental illness. And you go to school, you go to graduate school after college and get a PsyD or PhD, and you become a psychologist. And then you have to go through licensure and so on. But we were not, you're not able to prescribe medications.
Right. So again, just so folks have a little understanding, we've already established I'm a medical professional, but what do you then do as a psychologist?
And so back in the 90s, the Department of Defense, it was like 1991 to 1997, they decided to do a pilot project to see if psychologists who were trained could prescribe medication to the Army. So there were 10 psychologists that went through the training, and it was a huge success. So after that, states started to talk about, well, maybe civilian psychologists, particularly with the mental health crisis, maybe if they got enough training, maybe they could do the same thing. So,
Right, but I think what I'm trying to get at, I think there's
yeah.
a lot of folks that are not even aware what you do as a psychologist, even if you're not a
Okay.
prescribing psychologist.
Okay. So I consider myself a generalist. And so patients come see me if they're anxious or depressed or they have marital problems. I do a consultation with them and we create a treatment plan and I see them in therapy. I do a lot of hypnosis, mindfulness. I'm a yogi. I incorporate that into my practice. So traditional psychotherapy with a little bit of holistic twist.
Okay, and then, but psychologists, they also do psychological testing.
Right. And so I do testing. I do memory testing for patients. I do personality testing, bariatric evaluations. I do testing for patients prior to surgery. So that's kind of my practice.
Okay. And then the testing then helps you it helps you kind of figure out
Is
maybe
this
certain
person?
areas, also in certain areas, one, if there's some brain dysfunction,
Right.
right?
So you could have someone come in and you might say, gee, they really seem depressed, but it really could be that there's some kind of dementia process going on.
Right.
If I do a screening and I feel
Well,
like
I'm
they,
just to say also, so things like, and again, I'm really trying to tease this out
yeah.
because I think it's really important that people have an understanding of the real benefits of working with a psychologist and the different tools that you all bring to assist people in working through. Whether it's depression, whether it's trauma, whether it's anxiety, whether it's ADHD, whether there's brain, traumatic brain injury, to really kind of tease that out so that they see how hugely beneficial it is, and especially even to have testing, because for instance, if you have problems with remembering things, problems processing things, if there's issues with determining what your IQ is. So
Right. It helps the patient because it objectifies what's going on for them. Because oftentimes they know there's something wrong, and then you can go back and say, okay, well, the testing is showing
that this
there, this
specifically
is
is what's happening with your brain, which is that's not
right.
working properly and is creating this problem.
Right. And so therefore, I will send you to the specialist or the specialist, depending on what the nature is of the problem.
Right. So
If
I think it's, you know, I always appreciated this as because in obviously when I was in residency, especially, but in medical school too, to some degree, you know, as a psychiatrist, you're trying to figure that out. And so as a psychiatrist, I don't do psychological testing, right? I don't do neuropsych testing. That's the domain of the psychologist. But again, as you're saying, it gives us an
The re
objective
it's it's
measure to
yes.
identify this brain dysfunction and then to
Right.
formulate a treatment, you know, treatment plan that's in keeping with that. You know, yes, it's in your head, but it's actually literally in your brain, right?
Yeah, and your body, you know, and educating them that, yeah, you are feeling things. You can't
Yes.
separate the two. And how do we go forward?
Right. So
And
you have, I'm sorry,
go
go
ahead.
ahead.
No,
Go
you
ahead.
go ahead.
So I was going to say, so you have a PsyD, and I know there's a PsyD. Some people have doctorates, but it's not always a PsyD. The PsyD is a doctorate in psychology, right?
Correct. You can get a PhD. Traditionally, the PhD was less clinical,
Okay.
and the PsyD was more clinical.
Okay.
And I did take more of a clinical path. So,
Got it. Got it. So I think now that we've gotten that teased, kind of teased out in terms of, you know, that your doctorate, you went to graduate school,
right.
right? You
Right,
went
so
to
you
grad.
went to medical school and I went to graduate school, right?
Correct. Correct. So, you know, very, very, so very different paths.
Yes.
So you get your PsyD. What kind of work were you doing at the time when you know, before you got into the training
So
program or?
when I graduated with my PsyD, I ended up going into a hospital, acute hospital setting for about 10 years.
Okay.
And so and we
Challenging.
were and we were kind of playing with moving around to different. I was working with cardiac rehab and the infertility clinic at McNeil Hospital in Berwyn, and the transitional care unit, and we were sort of, you know, feeling our way in terms of integrating behavioral health with medicine, as it
Okay.
was kind of new back then. But I was playing with these different, ways of working with different professionals, and it was successful.
All right. And so then tell me how doing that kind of clinical work in those various settings, again, how did your path lead you to that, to doing that study, in
To
connection
do
with the military?
this, oh, well, I didn't do that study in the military, but
Okay.
that study, I think, came out, that was in the 90s that that occurred.
Okay.
And so
And you were only
prior to,
five, right?
yeah, I was five, but I was not a part of that study. But no, I mean, back then, I wasn't really, this was so, gosh, when I started working at that hospital, it was 1992. I was kind of thinking about prescribing, but I really was much more involved with psychotherapy and testing. And I had started my private practice at that time as well. And that's when I was also teaching at Elmhurst. I don't do that anymore. Then I moved into clinical hypnosis. I was really intrigued by that and involved with the Chicago Society and did end up becoming past president. I finished that in like 2000, but I still do hypnosis and mindfulness and the yoga. And that all I felt like really it was a complement to what I did as a psychologist. So I knew probably in the, let's say after I got married, so like 2000s, early 2000s, that this was kind of on the horizon because New Mexico was the first state in 2002. And then 2004 was Louisiana. It was kind of out there. But the psychologist that sort of spearheaded this whole thing in Illinois, she was the president of IPA at the time. Her name was Dr. Beth Romreimer. So I would say my discussions with her kind of inspired me to move forward with this. And I remember having an interesting conversation with another psychologist at the time. A lot of psychologists were very much against this and were really concerned that this would change the field of psychology. And he was a mentor of mine, and he said, he said, it really doesn't make sense to me that you would consider this, given the fact that you are much more holistic in nature. And he said, I don't see those that is meshing. And I said, really, on the contrary, I said, if I want to understand the whole person, wouldn't it behoove me to understand what's going on with the brain? I don't want to be a psychiatrist. I think it's a different field. And since then, he has agreed with me. So I didn't quite know what it would look like, but I jumped into the training about 2 weeks after I had a discussion with Ram Rimer. And so I was 47, I'll be 57 next week. So it's been a lot, quite a journey. I had two young kids, probably in their late, well, middle school, grammar school. My husband was working in Utah. So I was balancing my practice, and I thought, I'm going to go for this. I thought it made sense at the time.
Okay.
So it was 2014 that Illinois passed the law, and I was a little shocked by that because a lot and there was a lot of lobbying against it too, which I understand. And so when the law passed, it was a much more stringent law than Louisiana or New Mexico. So would you like me to tell you how that looks? And so
Yeah,
you
I
have
mean,
to
just
be,
yeah, I mean,
yeah, you
obviously,
got to be a
what is it, what it
clinical.
looks like, what does it look like here in Illinois?
In Illinois, you must be a clinical psychologist licensed in Illinois. Then you go on to get your master's in psychopharmacology. So that was 2 years. There are three programs. I think there are four programs now that offer that. I went to Alliant in California. You also have to take several undergraduate pre-medical courses. So I think there were 9 or 10 of those that I had to do. If you did them during your undergrad, hallelujah, you didn't have to do them.
So what were some of the classes that you had to go back and take?
Chemistry with labs, microbiology with lab, anatomy, physiology, anatomy and physiology, medical terminology, biology. Am I missing some? Statistics, which I already had, pathology. I think that covers most of them. So we had to do that. Then you have to pass the national exam. So that's the next hurdle. And then Illinois requires us to do medical rotations from 14 to 28 months. And those included psychiatry, OBGYN, emergency medicine, family practice, internal medicine, an elective. I chose neurology, surgery. I did neurosurgery. What am I missing? Geriatrics,
Okay.
pediatrics. Now the Illinois law, it's very clear. We're not allowed to work with anyone under 18 or over 65. No pregnant women, no one with any very severe medical challenges like cancer, heart disease, diabetes, seizure disorders. We are not allowed to prescribe stimulants. So it's very, very specific to a certain population. And I just had a, yeah, so I was licensed in 2020, and I've had a patient I've been doing psychotherapy with for years, highly anxious, who never wanted to try a medication. And so 2 years ago, I started her on buspirone, very, very low dose. And it's been working well. And next week, she turned 65, so I cannot prescribe her anymore. So that's an interesting situation to be in. So I have to refer her out.
Right, although at least in her case, because of the medication she's taking, probably a primary care provider could do that
Right,
with
right.
with a level of comfortability.
Right.
I know, obviously, at this point in time, number one, not only am I an adult psychiatrist, but I'm a child and adolescent
Okay.
psychiatrist as well. So I'm double boarded,
Okay.
and there's, as you well know, there's a shortage of psychiatrists, but there's a
Yes.
huge shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists.
And
So
yes, and I think, and I know that we're trying to go back and lift those age restrictions because the child and adolescent psychologists could certainly work with the younger patients. That's not an avenue I would ever take because I don't work with that population.
Yes. So it was, one of my Dr. Espinoza, he was actually, because as a physician, again, we do different rotations. And so I was
Right.
doing radiology at what was then the West Side VA. I think it's Jesse Brown now. But Dr. Espinoza, in his wonderful teaching style, he's the chief of radiology. And so I'm doing the rotation, and so talking about what I want to do, and child and adolescent psychiatry, he's like, "Oh, so you like the little vets?" So I'm like, "Yeah, I like the little vets."
I could see you working with children. I think that's wonderful. That's a talent in and of itself, for sure. And then you've got the parents to work with too. It's
yes, it means work
can
to
be
me. It means
challenging.
working with families, right? It means
Yes.
working with families. But I think it also, if we keep in, as you well know, there are many people because of either unresolved or unhealed childhood wounds, in terms of childhood experiences, in addition to just, flat out trauma, people that get and losses, grief, all of that are really, they're still stuck at some point in childhood. So although I'd like to say, we're oftentimes dealing with the mind and emotions, of a child or an adolescent in an adult body.
Absolutely.
Right. So, but I'm sorry, you were saying about the fact that in terms of prescribing for your patient who you have on
Yeah,
control for anxiety.
right. And most of my patients in my practice, I do psychotherapy with. And I wouldn't say that I'm prescribing to everybody. And I think that was a fear. Oh my God, you give those psychologists a license to prescribe and they're going to go bananas. And it's quite the opposite. It really is. I'm really very tempered and very conservative. And if I, and I think it's important for your audience to know that for those of us who've chosen this path, and incidentally, as of today, there are only 19 of us in the state. And total in all five states, maybe 250. So we're not talking big numbers here.
No.
But
Tiny, tiny
we
numbers.
be right, compared to like nurse practitioners and PAs, and it's a very small number. But we really think it through, and if we think this is a case that is way beyond what we can handle, we refer out. And that's what we do anyway as psychologists. I think that's important to know. We collaborate with primary care and psychiatry and neurology, and it's something that we it's our nature. We're very
Yes.
collaborative in nature.
Yes. And I think, and as you were talking, I was also thinking about too, there is overlap in what we do. So while I may be more medically based, I do therapy with my patients as well.
Yes, I
And
can.
so it's and as you well know, therapists, there's different credentials, as it were.
Right.
So whether you as a psychologist or me as a psychiatrist or someone who's an LSW, licensed clinical social worker, or LCPC, licensed clinical practicing
Yeah, counselor.
counselor, there's different kinds of therapists with different credentials. But again, with you and I, there is overlap. And for me, here's the way I say it. I look at it from a place of mental wealth, with this term I
Yes.
use, mental wealth, that I define as brain health plus transformative thinking. And
Yes.
so it's important to have the right solution for whatever the problem or the issue is. Another way, simple way of saying it is, if you run out of gas, it's not going to help you to put air in the tires.
Right.
Right?
And
So,
yeah,
right, you know what I
as
mean?
you're yes, and as you're talking, I'm thinking like how mental health has changed. And so we're calling it kind of like a mental health crisis. I almost think in a sense, more and more people are just open to the notion of getting help. I mean, back when I was a kid, if you had problems, you didn't want anybody to know. And it wasn't until you crashed and burned and some horrible things happened.
Right. And I think that's really rooted in the fact that if you think about it, it's really rooted in that if people see you as too different for them and too unusual, I'm being kind,
Yeah.
because they would just say crazy, right?
Right. Yeah.
That potentially what it meant was that you got marginalized. People didn't want to be bothered with you. Use this plain simple term. They won't be
Right.
bothered with you. They don't want to deal with you. They don't want to interact with you. But then they're also subject to attack you. So
Yes.
the appearance of there being something wrong with you, as opposed to I have a brain, so there's something wrong with my brain, is the
Right.
fact that I get disconnected and potentially harmed as a consequence, of
Yes.
that. What does this say about me and who I am? I'm weak, I'm not good enough, I'm not this, all these things that it really doesn't mean, and so
Right.
I need help. So
It's right. It's an organ in your body that might be dysfunctional, like your heart, like anything else.
correct. And some people, would benefit from, medications, vitamins, minerals, whatever, but then again, if you need some air in your tires, it's not going to help you put gas in the tank. So if a person doesn't need medication, but they don't have the tools to heal their wounds, then that's where any therapist comes in. I mean, I say any therapist, meaning whether it's you as a psychologist or
Sure.
whomever else is providing therapy, is to give a person additional tools.
Right. And understand and helping them. The other part of that, I think of going back to that whole dentistry parallel. You go in, you get your tooth is kind of, back in the day, you didn't take care of your mouth. You have a toothache, you go in, they just pull your teeth. Now it's preventative medicine, preventative mental health, preventative brain health. None of us are in the human condition. We can't escape things happening that might cause our mental health to fail us. Teaching people about their stress thresholds and where they are, and what are your triggers? How do we stay, keep ourselves well on a daily basis?
Yeah, so how do you manage your stress? For instance,
Yes.
keep it in the realm of also, in terms of therapy, because I try to teach people that there's a chemical component to what you think and feel and experience. And if it's highly stressful, then you get chemicals released in your body like cortisol, which it's fine if it's for a brief period, but over extended periods, what's going to end up happening is it's going to cause damage, right? It's going
Right.
to increase your blood pressure and decrease blood flow and impair your immune system. So all these different things that are happening are going to create illness if it happens, chronically over time. So stress killing is a real medical condition.
Yes.
So again, to come back with you and the work that you do, it's really critically important, right? So
Right.
what do you see, as you know as well, let's say, what do you see as the benefits of being a therapist, being a prescribing psychologist, for anyone who might benefit from, your unique skill set?
Well, so I'll go back to this anxious patient of mine. She, again, worked with her for years and really lots of panic. Just, couldn't get out of that fight and flight. So in psychotherapy, you did a lot of education about we're changing your neural pathways by talking. It might take a little bit longer. I always wanted her to try medication, and this was back before I could even prescribe. And she was dead set against it. Anxious people are afraid. So the benefit for me helping her is the fact that she knew me for a long time. And when I finally was able to prescribe, I said, let's just try this really small dose of something. And if it doesn't work, you go off it. And I'll see you next week. I think I tried her on 5 milligrams of buspirone to take at night. She was terrified. She'd purchased, she picked it up at at Walgreens, and she said, I just don't know if I'm going to do it. Finally, she did, and I don't know if it's placebo. Anyway, she's up to 30 milligrams a day and is doing quite well. So the benefit was me being able to work with her on a weekly basis, knowing her for a longer period of time. It was very rewarding.
Yeah, because you have an opportunity to establish relationship and rapport and therefore trust.
Right. So maybe tops I see 25 people a week in my practice. Now, up at Ascension at the Community Mental Health Center, they hired me to do just medication management. So that's a real different kind of beast for me. I've got 20 minutes and they just, they don't want me to take any longer time. And I had suggested that maybe I did both the therapy with the med management, and they just wanted me to do med management. So that's been a unique experience.
I'm sure. I'm sure. So I was gonna say, so let's talk about something I think that's probably pretty obvious, which is, as you said, you're not a physician, you're not a nurse practitioner, you're not a, a PA or physician assistant, as a non-medical person. And because of the pandemic, and the tremendous stress that it's put on people, and the demand for the services of mental health. One, I also, of course, try to educate, because, from a basic, I think people need to understand that your body can't live without a brain. And so you need to take care of your brain health so that, because it's all connected, right? Your brain and your body is inseparable from the rest of your bodies. Like I said, it's not in a separate container. So in that context, again, the healthier your brain is, the better your life is, both in terms of brain function, but also in terms of the thoughts we think. So in terms of what's happened with the pandemic, has that changed, any aspect, either in terms of the amount, the way you, is there any differences in how that or how you engage with people, just anything that's happened because of that?
Well, the telehealth obviously became more profound. And I must say I don't enjoy it. I really want to see someone and experience them and the office. So there are a few patients that I have not seen since, and I just do telehealth with them. And I've just had some conversations this week and said I'd really like to get you back in the office. It's important to see you live at least once in a while. So I would say that I think it's easier for patients. So that's kind of the logistics of it. But in terms of just the whole pandemic, I think the stress levels for everybody has just been, especially older teenagers. I do see people 16, 17, 18, college students, older people. It's been very profound. Older people who were used to going to church and couldn't go to church anymore, that was their sense of community. Going to the grocery store, just greeting people, they lost all of that, not getting out of their houses. High school kids, and I wasn't working with the younger ones, but having to be with the same small group over and over and over, and that's the time in your life when you're supposed to be exploring new people, and that's how you learn about yourself and within the context of others. I think it caused terrible depression and anxiety, and all kinds of things popped up that normally I don't think would have happened. And I think people are still struggling.
Right. So I think with the kids in particular, and I'm using kids broadly, so whether they're small kids or whether they're adolescents, I think the issue with them in particular was really around the fact that their identity is still forming. And so you and unfortunately, this is a society that grounds value in doing. It's what I do. What have I accomplished? What did I screw up? What did I mess up? And so then if the environment that you're in terms of school, gave you some means for success, whether it was academic, whether it's athletics, whether it's some combination, whether it was social, whatever that was, and those things that affirm your value, then you take that and remove it from someone whose identity is not fully formed and grounded in doing instead of being, then I think that was a huge issue. I think the other issue, whether it was for the kids or even the adults, is of course being with people more often, like family. Increases conflict, right? Increases some people getting abused more, not having more opportunities to seek help, you know what I mean? Because they don't have privacy, they don't have opportunity.
More addictions, drinking to escape.
Correct. Again, because people don't necessarily have the proper tools, as I like to say, there's no permanent solution and a temporary fix. So you're not fixing what's really bothering you. You're not healing it. And on top of it, now you're adding on another problem because what you're doing is not the proper solution. And it's adding on another problem when you turn to drugs and alcohol and or any other kind of substance. So I think those were certainly some of the challenges. And I wanted to you actually segue into something you were talking about earlier, because I'm obviously a big proponent of integrative holistic approach, because again, we're not separate, right? The brain's not separate from the rest of the body. We're not separate from the environment. We're impacting the environment. The environment is impacting us. And I really don't think people sit down really consciously and think about those things as much as would benefit them. And the reason I bring that up is because, like, for instance, if I tell people, if I take an orange seed and I plant it in the Antarctic, I shouldn't be surprised that it doesn't grow. It's not the right environment.
Yeah, that's a really
Right.
nice analogy.
It's not the proper environment to give it what it needs for it to grow and to thrive. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with the orange seed. It's just the wrong environment. And
And
then
nothing wrong with the environment.
correct in that instance. But sometimes, when it comes to people, though, in the environments that we inhabit, the environment th there it needs some changing, right? It needs some adjustments. So So I wanted to, because again, you and I think we're so similar in our mindedness, right?
Yes.
So I wanted to bring in, of course, the your use of, mindfulness and hypnosis, and just actually so people know, I've actually have used hypnosis and just recently went back to using hypnosis for weight loss, actually. And for
Okay.
me, yeah, for me, it definitely works. I've used it also in the past, and it has many benefits, infertility and many things. So you're talking about mindfulness, the hypnosis, and can we talk about that as
Yes,
well,
yes.
how you use it in your care of patients and its benefits?
Well, I'm thinking about your analogy with the orange seed and Antarctica, and it's not that either one of those spaces is bad or unhealthy. They just don't work together. So think about couples. And so I do a lot of couples work, and it's people are so quick to say, well, we're just, the marriage is dissolving because they're a horrible person. And oftentimes you just can't label it. They're not great together. They don't bring out the best in each other. The orange seed will not grow with some people being together.
As I like to say, they're not a good fit.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, my
They're
size,
not.
size 11 foot will not fit a size 9 shoe.
Yes. Yes. So neither one of you are bad people. It's just not a great fit.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not the shoe. It's not my
Yes.
foot. Just not a good fit.
Right.
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 And
So
even
that
all
can.
11s don't fit.
Yes. Exactly. Or they don't fit perfectly. Or you can get a callus.
Or some of them hurt, frankly. I'm talking about
Yes,
even some
they do.
11s. Like, well, you can stretch them. Well, no, I don't really do. So it's
Right.
just I'm saying that to say I absolutely agree with you that it would
Yes.
be so useful if people looked at it that way, that that you're discussing when it comes to themselves and partners or potential mates.
Yes.
So
And
yeah, sometimes
then,
they're a good fit.
yeah, and even within themselves, judging their, past behaviors and, trying to, I just saw somebody this morning. He's, an incredible guy, but was an addict a long time ago, but he's overcome it. He's worked really hard, and he still does daily. And he said, oftentimes I think to myself, I'm an imposter. If my team that worked for me really knew, then, they wouldn't see me as a leader. And I think there's a lot of shame there. And I think you need to love that part of yourself, incorporate that. That is who you are. That is part of who you are. It's not bad or good. It just is.
So, do you use mindfulness with him or?
Yeah, I do. So I do a lot of actually more informal hypnotic techniques, using certain verbiage. I don't necessarily have them lying on the couch and going through a whole I do with some people,
Okay.
but it's the way I use my voice. It's maybe what we've been talking about. And I might use some interesting analogies. And then they come
So,
back and
what is it? So, for some folks, they don't necessarily know
yeah.
what mindfulness is. So,
Okay.
what is mindfulness and how does
So,
it benefit one
yeah.
in the healing process?
Okay. So being mindful is being completely engaged, your mind, body, and spirit. Takes a lot of practice because we are distracted all the time as human beings. And so I think I learned mindfulness probably when I started yoga, because you can't do poses and anything if you're looking around. So you've got to be on your mat. And I use that, and I say to people, let's stay on your yoga mat. So it takes a lot of practice. So I teach people, I say, don't, and you don't have to do long, drawn out mindfulness meditations. Find yourself a little app. Sometimes they record me, and you can do it for 5 minutes. You can do it for 2 minutes. And just listen, stay focused, allow your body to relax and soften your face and feel just experience it. And some people never do. I mean, a lot of people will say, you know, most of us are crunched over our computer, so we're always feeling tense and we're not breathing properly. Our shoulders are not there. I mean, and so we're not mindful. We're just like little machines that are breaking down. So yes, I try to teach very tiny baby steps and hope that they can work that into their daily life. So for example, I'll say, you get up in the morning, you set your tone for the day. How do you lead an anti-inflammatory lifestyle? It's kind of a mundane life, but
So
how do you
what is
find
that? What is
joy?
so so what is that? So why so what does that mean? And when I say what does that mean, why are you
Yes.
raising the issue of you know, in terms of an anti-inflammatory life? Of course, I know what you're getting at,
Right.
but
Well, and so you talked about the notion of fight and flight. Your sympathetic nervous system is on fire, and so your cortisol is going crazy. And if that's going on all of the time, and that could be good stress, or it could be positive or negative stress, actually. If you're just always excited and on and doing, you're going to burn yourself out. Causes inflammation on the brain and the entire body, and things start to break down. Cancer, you know, you name it.
right, because the inflammation is interfering with the body's normal functioning,
Yes.
right? So that's what the importance of it. And
And so I try to teach patients like you to how do you lead that kind of a calm and peaceful lifestyle? It's a daily practice of small things. Getting up at the same time every morning. You know, don't just run out the door. You know, take if you can, take the 10 minutes, you know, take some time to think
wait,
about.
Dr. Gretchen, don't be out me. Don't be out me, Dr. Gretchen.
Now, some people it works for them, like you, Dr. Fallon, it works for
I don't know. I don't know how well it's working. I know I'm doing it. I've been doing it for a long time, but I don't know if it, you know.
But it's hard to do. Yes, absolutely. And I'm not suggesting this is an easy process, but all of these little components can help you lead a healthier life. Going to bed at the same time every night, if you can, you know,
And
really
why is that
winding.
important? And that's what I want to get into. And so let me do this. And we're going to come back to why the importance of sleep and going to bed at the same time. The reason I specifically was asking about mindfulness, because again, I think for many people it seems abstract, it seems woo-woo, it seems unscientific. And therefore, like, why should I do this? And to me, what I try to help people understand, and you've already talked about it, is that it's a means of placing yourself in your body. If I'm talking about myself personally, of me placing myself in my body and connecting to myself, my thoughts, my feelings, what's happening in my body. In our case of doing yoga, where my body is in space, because I do yoga also. It's extremely helpful to me in terms of managing and helping with my stress. One of the things I know some people have difficulty doing, though, in the being sitting still, meditating kind of thing, mindfulness, is I tell them you can do a walking meditation or anything can be a mindful activity. And one of my favorites is actually if I'm washing a dish, because and you can see and I and oh and oh my gosh, it's such a wonderful experience because I'm feeling the dish and the warm water and the soap, and there's all of these things in the experience that I miss when I'm not mindful because I'm up in my head thinking about whatever it is I'm thinking about, but not the experience that I'm actually having. And so there's things, you know, there's so there's things. There are things that I'm missing, positive, pleasurable, beneficial things that I'm missing in the experience because I'm checked out and disconnected from the experience.
And I would guess too that when you're washing the dish, you're doing it very slowly, which helps you become more mindful. We're all so used to doing everything quickly. If you weren't mindful, you'd probably break the dish. Which would be a symptom, or it would be telling you, Got to
So
move a little bit.
I think in the simplest terms, mindfulness is a way to connect to myself and the experience that I'm having in the moment, to fully immerse myself in the experience so that I
Yes.
fully get the benefits of the experience.
Right. And so that, and so you kind of started to talk about the sleep thing, and that's the same idea. You know, you don't just want to check out, you're watching TV on the computer, not engaged with yourself, and try to fall asleep.
Right. So what's the benefits of sleep, going to sleep, especially at the same time every night?
Well, you will get up at the same time. You will get the same amount of sleep. You will have a normal sleep cycle. It all works together. You'll feel better in the morning. You know, you think about when you're younger and you've got haphazard sleep and you don't realize how it affects you.
So, but
And
isn't
your body will start to tell you.
Right, but isn't it also one of the benefits of sleep is that your mind gets to process things of the day and then
Yes.
gets to dump out some of the trash, as it were.
Right. So there are these proteins called amyloids that you want to, you know, so right. So that's the time for the brain to cleanse. And
And you
if
know, and
go ahead.
I'm just going to add this too, because you mentioned amyloid plaques, which people are connected to, you know, Alzheimer's. Again,
Yes.
to when you were talking about inflammation, again, to the problem with inflammation is that it damages body structures, it damages tissue. And when, of course, if it damages tissue, then that means it's not going to work properly. So you're trying to tell it, go to sleep the same time every night.
Right, they have to have a dark spit room, and you have to get your little mask if your room's not dark enough, and a nice cool room. And I just kind of describe it as winding down. I said, you've got this diurnal clock. And, you know, back when we were, you know,
What was
prehistoric,
the diurnal clock?
you know, it's so in the morning, you got all the energy. Oh, you don't have one? I think you did send me that email at 2 in the morning. Yours is a little off, but it's okay. It works for you. And
No, you
that's
know,
the
I
other.
swear, you know, I tell, I
But
tell,
that's
you know, you know,
important.
but you know how people say I'm a morning person. So I just it was talking to the CMO and somebody else. And they, you know, and that's why I said, you know, she's part surgeon. So she's like, oh, wee hours of the morning. We have meetings at 7 a.m. at times once a month. And I said to her, I said, so she, you know, she's part surgeon. I said, morning person, the morning person. I said, I'm a morning person too. I just prefer to go to sleep at 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in
Oh,
the morning.
God. But you see, but this is important information because for you, genetically, biologically, it works. You're able to function.
I'm going, can I just see
You
some
know,
patients at midnight or one
right?
o'clock?
You probably could
So,
in Hawaii or something.
yes. So you were talking about the importance of going to sleep at a regular time.
Right. So, you know, we talk about winding down and that, you know, I give you know, I talk about, you know, prehistoric times, you were forced to do that, right? You were forced to live by the environment. You know, there were no lights there, you know, you went to sleep and that's how you did it. But now we can be up doing day and night. You really would never have to sleep. And so how do you create that space so you lead a healthier lifestyle? It takes a lot of practice.
So what are you know, I think of, again, what are, say, maybe three simple things that a person could do to help improve their mental health that doesn't involve medication. And I'm saying this slowly because one of the things that I always know to be true is that people are looking for, they tend to look for like the magic pill
Right, the quick fix.
or the bullet. Yeah. You know, like the micro, I call it the instant grit fix, right?
Right, you
And,
know.
you know, and something that's got a whole lot of wow and pow and pizzazz. And, you know, and many things are very simple, and but they also don't have a lot of flash or pizzazz. But they are things that if you do them and you do them consistently, if that becomes your practice,
Yes.
that it can be very effective. And no, it's not the magic pill or the magic bullet or the magic anything. So but you do have to get in there and do them. So what are like maybe three simple things people could do?
Well, the overarching theme would be finding the beauty in a mundane life, finding peace and joy in slowing down.
Okay.
That's
Get
number
it, get
one.
it, get it. And what do you have some suggestions for? And I'm sorry, you said one, that was one thing. Were there, did you have two others maybe?
So, trying something different, maybe that you've never thought of before. So instead of, I don't know, again, when you make, I think big changes are too dramatic for people. So, just turning off your computer at night once.
Okay, so you don't have to
You,
fly to Paris.
right, exactly. You don't exercise at all. Get up, at your desk, if you're at your desk, get up for, 5 minutes and do some marching in place.
Okay.
Little tiny changes will
And
lead to habits, better habits.
okay. And I was sitting up here thinking about this, so and I'm like, oh, I want to make sure I get this in, which is, again, given the shortage of psychologists, and of course we've already talked about, you said there's 19 prescribing psychologists in the state of Illinois. What are some ways that you would recommend for people to, find a psychologist in order to get the therapy that could be very beneficial for them changing their lives?
So, if you're using your insurance, always call your insurance provider and see. They'll give you a list of people in the area, and then maybe look them up and just see, will they are they a good fit for you? And that's the one thing I tell all my patients. If there's no relationship there, then move on. So you're consulting with the psychologist just as much, to see if you feel comfortable with them. And if you don't, there's no shame in that. Go on to the next provider.
But I do advise people, because this comes up all the time. I do
Yeah.
advise people that how you interact with your therapist is how you interact in your relationships. So
Right.
if you have some concerns, don't just walk away from the relationship never having had the conversation. It's important
Right.
to express whatever your concerns are and however you think your needs are not being met, so that they at least have an opportunity to do that. And again,
Right.
it becomes a way how you it becomes a way for you to practice and learn valuable relationship skills with your therapist that you can then translate to other
Yes.
relationships.
Right. It's the microcosm, right? That the whatever is going on between the two of you is typically how you do interact with others. So that's excellent. Yes, I would definitely agree with that.
So you said check your insurance
Check
and
your insurance. I mean, everybody, all psychologists today usually have some kind of a website or can tell you a bit about themselves. Feel free to
is an association website that people could check too?
the Illinois Psychological Association does have a whole list, a directory.
Okay.
The Illinois Association for Prescribing Psychologists, we have a directory too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ask friends and
And
family that you know
ask
that
your
has a good
family.
therapist.
Pardon me?
Ask friends
Ask
and
your friends
family
and
that you
family.
know that has a good therapist.
Yes, ask them. Ask your primary care doctor. Ask
Okay.
your psychiatrist. And so, again, it's word of mouth. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for being here with me and having these conversations. And the thing that I really want to emphasize, like I said, I was so excited to have the conversation with you today, because again, how I conceptualize the work that you do as a therapist and the work I do as a psychiatrist is I tell people, if number one, if someone breaks your leg, they're responsible for breaking your leg. But because it's your leg, you're responsible for healing it. And if you don't know how to heal your leg, then you need to get help. And so and the average person, I don't think they feel shame about not knowing how to heal their broken leg. And so that they should think about it the way they think, you know, if their brain is not working function properly, I have a brain, but I'm not my brain, just like you have hands and you're not your hands. And if you don't know how to heal it, there's no shame in it. Nobody knows how to do everything. You know, nobody, if you don't necessarily know how to fix your roof, your plumbing, you call somebody. So the way to think about a therapist then is this is a person who has knowledge and information and tools and training that I don't have. I don't know how to heal myself. Let me get someone who can help me the same way I would get someone to help me heal my broken leg, right? The doctor, the physical therapist, and whomever else is involved in that process. And so
A team.
right. But I'm saying, but even if it's just you in particular as a therapist, seeing your therapist, they have knowledge and tools to help you heal past wounds, to help you learn how to look at yourself and ask questions. What am I thinking? How am I feeling? Helping you face your fears, helping you to transform your grief, right? And so that you're not stuck and that you can move forward and create the life you want. That's what a therapist does. They bring that knowledge and those skills to you to help that you can then add to your toolkit to get the life that you want and not be stuck in a life you don't want. And there's no shame in that, right? There's
And one of my favorite quotes that kind of ties that all up in a bow is it's never too late to be what you might have been. You don't have to be stuck in whatever narrative that you have given yourself that creates
Correct.
pain.
Correct. And because, yeah, because sometimes, you know, so here's what I tell people. For me, in my belief system, again, we are the wonderfulness of the universe appearing as us, right? We're spiritual beings in a physical body. So who we are is already whole and perfect. That energy being is already whole and perfect. But some of our thinking is jacked up as hell.
It is.
It's twisted, it's distorted, it's sideways, it's all kinds of needs some kind of, you know, detangling, right?
And it's not like going in and doing a lube job on your heart. You've got to put some work into it. It's very challenging.
So that's again the beauty of your talents, your skill set, in addition to the fact that you have the additional ability to prescribe for certain people that you think is important and then refer them out. So, you know, I just real quickly, how can people get in touch with you?
My website is drgretchenbowles.com. DrGretchenBoules, B as in boy, Boules.com. My phone number is 630-321-9809. And as an aside, my partner, Dr. Bone, who's also a prescribing psychologist and neuropsychologist, we are going to be launching a telehealth platform. So hopefully we can help other people outside of the urban Chicago area. She's actually from Sandwich, and so she sees a lot of rural patients. And so we thought that was a way to access give access to people that are not within our circle here in Chicago.
Awesome. Awesome. You on social media?
I'm working on that.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Working on
All
that,
right.
yes.
All right. Well, you know what? Again, I just want to you know, thank you for the work that you do and thank you for having this conversation with me, you know, to awaken and empower people, to help them to give them tools to heal and to live their best life.
Well, I really appreciate it. I'm so honored that you invited me here today. And again, thinking of energies, I was immediately drawn to you when I met you. And so obviously we've got very similar energy and I really appreciate it. You're
Yes.
lovely and so thank you.
Well, you know what? The same here. I have a great appreciation for you as well. I call women goddesses, divine feminine energy. So Dr. Goddess Gretchen Bowles, thank you so much for appearing with me
Oh,
today.
thank
And
you.
so and it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I am your host, Dr. Valen A. Durr, awakening and empowering you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit valinadurmd.com, spelled valinadurrmd.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.